It's The Business.
The Hot Desk with Mary O'Neill on WLR.
Thanks to MK Brazel, Chartered Accountants and Tax Advisors.
Good evening. You're very welcome along to tonight's Hot Desk. Between now and 7 o'clock, we are going to hear how a lot of people looking for jobs are getting annoyed because they feel their application forms are being screened by AI, and also cyber risk and cyber security. What can you do to prevent it? I will talk to Damien Smith from Campion Insurance about that. All coming up on the Hot Desk between now and seven. I hope you can stay with me. Well, it's 5 years, give or take, since the country went into lockdown. And of course, many, many things came out of COVID, and there were the serious health issues was the most important part. But it did put a magnifying glass, I suppose, out of necessity to begin with, on different ways in which we work. Hybrid, flexible, remote working became a thing. I mean, many companies were already doing it, but it became a widespread thing out of necessity, and then it kind of hung around. And now, 5 years on, we're still not sure what the magic formula is. Meg Dunphy is from Waterford. She's also the head of policy and engagement with CIPD Ireland, and she's in studio to talk through it all. Meg, good evening.
Hi, Mary. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, thanks very much for joining the programme again, Meg. I suppose a quick overview for listeners who aren't aware of what you guys do at CIPD.
So CIPD is the professional body for HR and or OD and L&D. So we're the professional body for HR professionals. We provide learning, we provide membership, we provide value with events and networking, and basically everything you need to know as a HR professional.
Great.
We
stuff.
Have it.
So this is very much your wheelhouse. Yeah. And again, it's a topic that comes up all the time. So I would imagine with the employers you talk to, it's a bit of a quagmire.
It is. And what I would say, Mary, is it's here to stay. Yeah. Flexible work is here to stay. So I think for years we were wondering, will it go back? But it hasn't. And it's so good for so many reasons. It's a good recruitment tool, retention tool, for well-being, for productivity. So there's lots of benefits to flexible work. And actually, if you look at the CSO, they have documented there's about 1 million now working from home. At whether wow. it's 1 day or 2 days or 3 days or whatever it is, but there's 1 million people in Ireland that are working from home at least 1 day per week. So I don't have the actual exact breakdown, but we are seeing more of a structured approach to it now. So it may have been more employee led and more consultation based, whereas now we are seeing a trend where employers have, you know, an expectation that they want to see people in the office more often, and we're definitely seeing that in Dublin. You'll see it from the traffic congestion up there as well. So we are seeing that. I suppose there needs to be a happy blend. Most employers are saying where there's office time for collaboration, for learning, for also new members of staff, early careers and so on, to benefit from each other. But then, you know, people who've now got used to working from home find it quite difficult in the office to concentrate. Mm. And there's a whole different dynamic going on where people have got into the habit of they have complete silence and they can be more productive in a home setting. But I do think there's a happy balance to be met, because too much working from home has isolation, you know, a tendency to blur the lines between personal life and not disconnecting. So there's lots of reasons why I think a blend is good. Now, some people do work fully remote and that can work in some situations too. But then you have to really lean into the digital tools and make sure that there is good collaboration on the team. And you would always still have some in-person, you know, occasions during the calendar, because completely remote is not going to work for anyone. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is it a case that these things in general need to be kind of hammered out at contract stage? Because I have heard of instances where people might, you know, be living somewhere that's quite far away from their place of work and getting on grand and it's all fine and dandy. And then the company decides, which is their right to be fair, that they want people in, I'm going to say 3 days a week. And all of a sudden you have people who can't do that. So is it a case that when you are maybe either renewing a contract in an existing job or signing up for an existing job or a new job, I should say, that you need to have those conversations to begin with?
I think it's a good time to do it. And we would see more of hybrid as the location on contracts. But more often than not, employers will want to put just the office base as the location. And then that allows them the flexibility of, well, we'll allow this flexible arrangement, but if at any stage we want to bring it back to the office, we have that scope. Mm-hmm. But as contracts go on and custom and practice, so somebody has a long-term working arrangement where it is hybrid or it is remote, it should be written into their location. And I know the consultation is out for the flexible request, right to request flexible working.
Yeah, it's a mouthful, isn't it?
It is.
Legislation.
Or,
yeah.
We have an abbreviation on it in work anyway. But so that's out at the moment. And I think things like that will be brought up. You know, so it's open for members of the public, just workers to
give their opinion,
but also employers and other kind of agencies and things like that as well. And I think that will come up as one of the things where location, if you are hybrid or, you know, should that be written in to your contract. So these kind of things are open for debate.
They are. And I think the legislation itself, I suppose people have accused it of being a little bit weak because, I mean, you're going to talk through it better than I will, Meg, but can you explain what exactly is the right that
so
it gives you?
So at the moment, you have the right to request flexible work, which means there is certain parameters where you have to give enough notice and your employer needs to get back to you within a certain period of time. And then they have to give you a decision within a certain period of time and an option to appeal that decision. Once your employer meets all those procedural expectations, they've done what they need to do. So if I've met all the timelines as an employer, I don't have to stand over the decision. So if it was brought to the WRC as a claim, I just need to have met the procedural aspects of the legislation. So they're not looking at
the yes or no.
The yes or no.
Okay.
Rather, it's, you know, was it done in as per the guidelines?
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, once an employer in its present format diligently sticks to the guidelines, they can say no all they want, basically.
They can say no, but they do need to stand over that for a business reason.
Okay.
And it can be contested, but the WRC are not going to look in and validate or test that decision.
Okay. So I suppose if people have a problem with the legislation as it stands now, is their time to do something about it?
I think give
their opinion.
There's been a massive uptake. Mm-hmm. On the consultation, so they've had lots of people giving them feedback on it. So I think the more we can actually get behind that and the government understand where are the challenges, I think that will be useful.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's so many different ways of looking at this. And from an employer's perspective, you know, if they're spending a lot of money running a building, especially, you know, if rents are high, rates are high, electricity costs, overheads, they're going to start thinking, well, people might as well be using it. But then the flip side of that is that, and this is the kind of ongoing argument, if I can be as good an employee as someone who's in the office and be just as productive and do my work without having the stress of having to commute, then surely it's only fair that I do. So it's kind of hard to see how all of that is going to be reconciled, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I think when you look at the fairness aspect of it, Mary, you know, employers need to be conscientious around it can't be one rule for one and another rule for others. However, there is also justification for that to happen. But you need to have, like, you know, some form of testing what's fair. You know, some jobs or roles that people do, they are forward facing, they're customer facing, and they're not able to work from home.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, but you can also look at, is there administration parts of the job where you could at least give a half day from home? So there's always ways, I think, where you can get creative with solutions for people. And if it means that they're going to stay with your business for another 3 years versus want to leave that job within the next 1 or 2 months, I think it's worth exploring these things with people.
Absolutely. And I think as well, what bothers most people is rules for the sake of it. So if somebody just imposes, I want you in the office because I can tell you I want you in the office, I think that annoys people. Whereas if there's a valid reason for coming in, like you said, for collaboration or, you know, maybe as an anti-isolation method, fair enough. But this kind of thing is, I'm the boss and I want to see you at your desk. I think that's what annoys people. You know, I think if people think it's warranted to come in, they'll come in.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, as an employer, it is a little bit more difficult, and as a leader, because we have to be so purposeful about our in-person days, and you can't just expect people to come in and then there's no planned meetings or they're doing things that they could have done at home. So if they're sitting there, you know, on their own, on Teams calls or whatever it is, where they could have done that at home, that isn't really fair to expect somebody to do a long commute, if that is the case, and come in and not have that engagement piece. So we have to be crafted about how we ask people to work and make sure that there is that collaboration piece when they are in the office.
So I suppose the wider question then, we'll finish up on this, Meg, is that, is it something that really can be kind of enforced at kind of a government level when it's as bespoke and as nuanced as you've outlined?
I think it's very difficult, Mary, and I think the other consideration we need to think about is we want to make sure that there's foreign direct investment continually coming into the country, and that the employers that we have here, both Indigenous and, you know, from other countries, are happy to stay. So we need to make sure that work environment, or that business environment, is conducive to that. And if we keep on adding complexity, you know, we do run the risk of, is it too expensive? Is it too complex? Is it too onerous to operate a business from here? So there is a balance between what's right for employees, what's right for businesses, and it's a minefield, to be honest.
So I suppose every business needs to look at their own operations, make sure they're doing things as fairly as possible, and make sure they're focused on staff retention, I suppose, really, at the end of the day.
I think, yeah, you'll need to look at retention, but you need to look at, for your business, you know, there's lots of different variations, and you can try and test things. I think you need to be brave enough to actually give things a go.
Yeah.
And like you said, not saying no for the sake of saying no. But yeah, it has to be operational. But there has to be flexibility.
Yeah.
That's what people expect now.
I know, and I think the younger generation in particular probably are coming into a whole new working world. I know I'm absolutely no longer in my 20s. I'm, you know, so far away from that stage of my life. But I think when I was young and in my 20s, I would have missed out on an awful lot of life if I didn't have the office life that I had then and the friends I made then. And that is all really important as a way to get to know people as well, isn't it?
It is important. And that's one of the things around, you know, hybrid offices, is that onboarding piece is very, very difficult for new staff coming in.
Yeah.
They're not learning by osmosis. They're not, you know, their networks are smaller. So we need to be creating spaces for them to be able to do that. So again, it's back to that purposeful design of collaboration.
It's a fascinating topic and one that's not going anywhere,
nope,
as you said. Meg Dunphy, Head of Policy and Engagement with CIPD, Waterford's Meg Dunphy. Thank you so much.
The Hot Desk with Mary O'Neill, WLR's business programme.
Thanks to MK Brazel, Chartered Accountants and Tax Advisors.
Rarely a week goes by on the Hot Desk that I don't talk about AI, short, of course, for artificial intelligence. But it is just such a massive part of life, and particularly working life. But it's actually causing a bit of a hindrance before people start jobs, it would seem. Professionals fear that AI is unfairly screening out their applications. And this is according to a new report by Collins McNicholas, a nationwide recruitment firm. And I'm delighted now to be joined on the line by Michelle Murphy, who's the director of Collins McNicholas, to talk us through the results of this research. Michelle, good evening. How are you?
Good evening. How are things?
I'm good, thanks. I suppose, tell us first of all why you wanted to carry out this research. What was the aim of it? What prompted you?
Yes, indeed. As you mentioned, we are a nationwide recruitment firm, and I suppose we really wanted to highlight the perspectives and priorities of the workforce and the professionals that are engaging with employers out there at this moment of time. And I suppose our sample or survey was conducted with workforce people who have been in touch with us during 2025, so over the last 10 months from January to October. So it really is a current and on-trend report. And we had just over 2,500 respondees. So we were absolutely delighted with the response rate in a period of 2 weeks. So it just goes to show that there was certainly an appetite for the workforce of the future to get their thoughts out there and suggestions and ideas. So that was great to be able to bring that now to the employers in Ireland and give them advice and some guidance if they are embarking on some recruitment over the next little while.
So 3 out of every 4 people seeking work feel that artificial intelligence could be unfairly screening out their applications. And I mean, is this accurate, do you think? Or is it more that maybe people have a feeling this is what's happening? Or is this actually happening? Are that amount of places using AI to screen applications?
Yes, and that's a really good question. And I do think there's probably a little bit of perception out there as well, you know, because obviously AI is such a new endeavor, really, when you think of it. And it has really grown from strength to strength over the last 12, 18, 24 months with the use of ChatGPT and all the different tools that are out there. And of course, automation is always happening. But I do think that possibly the workforce or candidates may be thinking they're hearing this. And, you know, maybe just drawing a little bit more of a conclusion around it. Certainly AI is being used. Not all companies are using it. So probably more in the multinationals and the large organizations have, I suppose, the resources to be able to purchase or work with AI tools, where maybe more of the small to medium enterprises may not be there yet. And that's certainly what we're seeing when we're talking to our client base. There's dabbling with AI. AI is there. It's easy to work with the likes of ChatGPT and those type of tools. But if you are embarking on a system that you're going to be working with to screen candidates for applications, that's a whole other investment for a company. So yeah. I think it's quite new, the concept, but certainly growing of interest in organizations.
And I think, I suppose, you know, language and tone really matters. And sometimes with the best intention, with automated language, it can come across quite badly. And that's something that came out of the survey as well, that almost 3 out of 4 again felt automated rejection emails were impersonal and dismissive. And only 6% strongly disagreed with that. And look, I have been shown rejection emails by friends who were quite disgusted, actually, at the obvious AI-ness of it all. And kind of like, could somebody not even take the time to personally send me a note saying, look, we've considered your application, unfortunately you're not successful, or, you know, or just say something by way of human feedback. So that maybe that's almost more hurtful than feeling you weren't included in the first place.
And anybody looking for a job or applying for jobs, it's quite a challenging time, maybe. And for some people, it's, you know, they're putting themselves out there, the confidence, all of these things are huge. And when we talk with candidates and the workforce, you know, that's what they're talking about. You know, the fact that they are going forward for a job, they don't know who's reviewing their CV. And obviously, if it's been reviewed and screened by AI in the first place, that in itself is daunting. But, you know, I do think exactly to your point there on the you know, emails that go out or responses that go out that are generated through automation, you know, they look and 99% of the times you can see that they're certainly generated through a system and through the use of AI. And a lot of the larger CRMs, so the systems that organizations would use for dealing with recruitment and that, would have built-in systems to respond. And that's where that already pre-populated emails go out, and they're set to go out. So that happens. And that happens in a lot of different other types of organizations as well, not just for recruitment, but or for HR within organizations. Lots of sales companies use it. I get them myself every day, and I can read them, and straight away I go, God, that certainly came from AI.
I know.
They're so impersonal, and they're just feel robotic and just going, you know, literally going out there with general terms. And plus, you can see the punctuation, and it's a dead giveaway.
Absolutely, a lot of the time. The long dash. Somebody pointed out the long dash to me, like kind of that elongated hyphen is a dead giveaway for AI.
Giveaway.
And
look, the comma before an end is another one.
Yes, and look, in many ways, it's been a massively helpful tool for people, and you know, for people that maybe, you know, writing long reports or emails doesn't come naturally to. I think it's great to have that aid, but it's always good to kind of, if you are going to use it, maybe let AI start the process for you, but then let a human kind of touch it up and put their own tone on it. You know,
absolutely.
Think,
And I think the data being used for AI, and I suppose it depends into how much information you go in around the use of AI. But certainly, you know, if you are using keywords for screening, you know, that you ensure that you train the data. So there's a whole different technique around that, that, you know, that there's no bias in that, that, you know, that you're getting a mix of demographics across race, gender, all the different areas. So you need to maintain a system, ensure that you're monitoring and validating it all the time before you actually go live with it, and that's really, really important. If you are using an AI system or an AI tool or CRM to screen, because that's, you know, where somebody could be unfairly screened out. And you know, I would say to organisations, you know, the power of meeting somebody, be it virtually, and we all use Microsoft Teams and Zoom and all that. That's become really popular, obviously, now, and it's a powerful course really for recruitment. But you know, that meeting face to face, you cannot beat that, because one of the other areas that people mentioned on, and certainly the feedback was, the culture of the company is really important. And they have a, you know, there's a huge probability of somebody turning down an offer if they get a negative impression of the company culture. And you can't, no AI is going to give that feeling of the culture. It has to be people to people. And, you know, if you know, the report is, certainly people can download the report and go through it. But outside of all those things, you know, the human touch or the human connection and the communication in a process is absolutely key to keep the applicants or the candidates engaged all the way through. And that's very, very important in this environment.
Yeah. And this report, I mean, you did extensive research. It was a total of over 2,500 responses.
2,500.
Yeah, I presume there were responses from Waterford in the southeast as well, there across the whole country and different sectors and age profiles. So it's interesting to see, you know, how strongly people feel about all this kind of thing as well. And I suppose, again, it kind of speaks to the fact that you're vulnerable enough when you're applying for a job in the first place, and you're certainly vulnerable enough when you're going for interviews, and to feel like a company wasn't even bothered, you know, like I said earlier, wasn't even bothered with that, is really important. Were there any sectors in particular where it came out more strongly than others?
Yes, and we did ask the question around job function and what sector do you work in. So certainly operations and manufacturing was very 17% representation in that particular sector. And then across engineering was very strong, also life sciences and medical med tech. So it is a national survey, and we actually did and can break it down as well through the counties and the regions. Mm. So we will be reporting back on that a little bit further in time. But just for now, we wanted to publish the results from a national perspective, because at the end of the day, like looking at the demographic, because we did ask your year of birth so that we could, if people wanted to give it, first of all, so we could look at the different generations. So between your Gen Z, your Gen X, your millennials, baby boomers, the response rate was very, very similar.
Okay.
The human connection, was really, really important, which in your own, you would actually think is quite surprising when you think of the generation, the Gen Z and Generation Alpha coming up as well, that you would think that they're obviously very clued into technology and to automation and AI and that. But nothing beats the people-to-people interaction. And, you know, again, no matter what generation you're in, it just shows the importance of that right through any process, be it recruitment or any other dealings that you have. People do like to have that discussion and interaction to really get the, I suppose, really to get to understand, be it the role or the opportunity that they're interested in.
Absolutely. And I suppose as well with the younger, the Gen Zs and, you know, the Gen Alpha even coming up through the ranks, maybe because they're so clued in, they just might be more aware or more discerning if they feel it's AI. Maybe that's how it's kind of balanced out a little bit. I don't know. I'm just kind of speculating here.
Yes. But and it's very true. Very true. They're probably more knowledgeable in that space certainly than myself or others. and, you know, again, because of that and the, you know, again, knowing that it's so much in use that, you know, they do respect the fact that there is, you know, a human somewhere in the organisation that could have a chat with them. Mm. And they prefer that.
Great stuff. We'll leave it at that. Michelle Murphy, Director of Collins MacNicholas. Where can people find out more about the research and the report?
Yes, absolutely. The report itself can be downloaded, the guide, through our website, so collinsmacnicholas.ie.
OK, Michelle, thank you very much, and hopefully we'll chat again soon. Thanks a million. Have a nice
evening. Thank you.
The Hot Desk with Mary O'Neill on WLR.
Thanks to MK Brazel, Chartered Accountants and Tax Advisors.
One of the biggest challenges facing any business out there these days is cybersecurity, breaches of cybersecurity. There's obviously the loss of privacy, the danger of data getting spread around, and then there's a massive financial cost as well. And there have been rising numbers of breaches, increasingly putting sensitive client data at risk across the accounting sector. And a company that has been looking into all of this is Campion Insurance, which has an office and the key in Waterford City. To talk more all about it, I'm delighted to be joined now by Head of Commercial at Campion Insurance, Damien Smith. Damien, good evening. How are you doing?
Very good, Mary. Thanks for having us on.
No problem at all. We hear a lot now about cybersecurity breaches of data. I suppose this was first highlighted maybe about 7 years ago or so when GDPR laws came in. But now everything is so much more sophisticated in terms of data. And also we have the added fear then of a cyber attack. So where do you see, I suppose, some of the pinch points or some of the vulnerable areas for customers and employers and businesses when it comes to cybersecurity?
Yeah, you're correct, Mary. Like, cyber events are increasing both in scale and sophistication over the last couple of years. And while we see the large companies get the news, so like M&S reported a 300 million loss, and Land Rover, Jaguar, you know, have reported a 198 million direct loss and a 485 million associated loss with it as well. It is the general SMEs that go unreported, and everyone feels slightly isolated in it and, you know, embarrassed to a degree, which they shouldn't be at all. We see reports here, so 75% of businesses have reported an increase in attacks, with 60% experiencing more than one event. So that just highlights the scale and depth of the issue at hand here on it. If you look at the reasons behind this, it is an increasing sophistication, and AI has really pushed this on. So most of the factors that are out there are phishing exercises, AI and social engineering. And they're resulting in increased ransomware attacks, data breaches, fund redirection, or what we're seeing more so now is a combination of all the above. And back to what you said earlier, like GDPR, IT forensic costs and legal can be absolutely crippling for a business when this happens. But more importantly than that is knowing where to go to. So again, if I'm sitting in my business here and I have one of these attacks, it's who do I call? And that's where cyber insurance in particular comes into play, where you're actually buying for the expertise behind that. So they will have a panel of experts and resources there that they will deploy straight away. Unfortunately, most of these incidents seem to happen at 5 o'clock on a Friday, and that's not by accident. That's due to the attackers understanding that businesses are winding down potentially for a weekend. Probably some of their key people may be gone, and you're left with a vulnerable business owner there to deal with this. So it is really important to have somebody there that you can contact straight away that will hold your hand, guide you and direct you through the process of it.
Absolutely. And taking out cyber insurance kind of sounds like something that a company really needs to put on their agenda. But I suppose that prevention is always better than cure as well, isn't it? And it's really important for companies to have safeguards in place in the first place as well.
Yeah, listen, cyber insurance is nice to have, but it doesn't take away from the fundamentals of basic cybersecurity. And the way I picture it is the same way as you might have fire insurance on a building or theft insurance on a building, you would still expect to have your windows and door locks, smoke detectors and fire alarm. So you should treat your security, your cybersecurity, in the same way as you treat your business. One of the first pieces start when one of these is staff awareness and staff training. To look, so staff can be aware to look out, what is a phishing email or an email that they don't understand. So before they click on the link, that they are looking for some of the signs that this, I'm not expecting an email from this person, I don't know this person, the format of the email address looks a little bit strange. So it instead of Damien Smith at Campion, that is Damien 1 Smith at Campion.
Yeah.
It's just those slight variances off it. Then patch and software updates. So having a program, a maintenance program in place to ensure that you're deploying and updating any patches or software updates. Because most of the time when companies are deploying these patches and softwares, they've discovered a vulnerability in their software, and these updates are there to design to close those windows. And the last one would have been multi-factor authentication. So many businesses now have not only your username and password, but also an app on your phone that you would click to confirm that it is you that's logging in. So even if your credentials were stolen by an individual, they would still need authentication or multi-factor from your phone to gain access to the system.
And it's like with everything, really, isn't it? I mean, you know, the interesting statistics around, 30% of Irish workers receiving no cybersecurity training in the past year. And that is particularly severe among SMEs. And I suppose it does go down to a resources thing as well. So, you know, when SMEs and even micro businesses are trying to juggle a million and one things, maybe it's just not something they're prioritising. But obviously, as you say, Damien, it can be horrifically costly if they don't.
Yeah, it should be part of your risk management. And again, I appreciate people may wear many hats in their businesses and different priorities. But again, same way as you take health and safety or fire training in a business, you should be looking at basic cybersecurity. Again, a lot of this can be done with minimal deployment there on it. And the first line of defence, again, is your staff and your own systems. Anything after that is expertise and additional layers there, that should the first line of defence fail, that you have something else there to back you up on it. And again, it's for businesses to understand, you know, what their current insurances do or do not cover. And again, not advocating that people go out and buy cyber insurance without understanding what is their risk exposure. And if it should happen to them, what is the knock-on effect? So, again, whether it's your professional indemnity insurance, you know, for accountants are required to have it for any errors or omissions that they may have when dealing with their client. It specifically excludes any cyber incidents. And the same way for a manufacturing business, you know, we'll have business interruption for a fire or flood or a major peril. But again, we'll exclude a cyber incident. And it's just for people to, I suppose, understand what risks they retain themselves, what they may like to offset against insurance, but fundamentally, what risk measures they're putting in their business to try and mitigate against any of these losses.
And you underline that the accounting sector is particularly vulnerable. Is this because of the kind of material that accountancy firms are dealing with, like tax files, payroll data, bank details, that kind of thing? Because most companies do have a lot of that confidential stuff as well.
Correct. It's the volume of that information, sure, that personal data that accountants have. And again, it is the threat of the ransomware. So what you'll see there is generally an attacker may lock them out of their system, but also threaten to release all that sensitive data onto the dark web, which both affects the business operations, but the reputational damage is unprecedented to a business where that happens as well.
Yeah, so I suppose all of what you said applies to all businesses, really, but some sectors are you know, more vulnerable, or it's more concentrated in some sectors due to what they're dealing with.
Correct, exactly. So everyone's exposed, everyone's vulnerable on it. But the more sensitive data that you hold, the more likely you are as a prime target for attackers to target you.
Mm-hmm. So I suppose the bottom line is, like we discussed, consider cyber insurance and look into it and see how you can get it and kind of the cost outlay of all of that. But first and foremost, kind of put safeguarding in place and invest in that. Because I'd imagine you've seen firsthand just, you know, how much money someone can lose and reputational damage and all that when there's a catastrophic cyber attack.
Yeah, like for small businesses, you know, it may be tens of thousands, but that is a major impact on cash flow. Again, through Camp Insurance, we have some useful tools here for people that we can deploy to them to let them understand what their risk profile looks like to the outside world, their cyber profile. So again, it's another tool there that we're happy to help customers understand what they have in place and what they should have in place. And like anything, it's easier to manage when you have a list there of what you can implement.
Great stuff. Okay, Damien Smith, Head of Commercial with Campion Insurance. Thank you so much for talking to me this evening. Very interesting. Thank you, Damien.
Thank you very much, Mary.
Thanks again to Damien, to Michelle and to Meg, my guests on tonight's Hot Desk. Thanks to MK Brazel, big sponsors of the show, and of course yourselves for listening. John O'Shea is on his way with The Late Show. Have a lovely evening. Good night.